Blog Talk Radio. California.
What is going on, everybody? Thank you guys once again for tuning in to another episode of Inside the Octagon. I'm your host, Kalani Lua, and yes, it is another week. And man, oh man, is it an interesting one at that. We had UFC this past weekend. We got UFC coming up this current weekend. Fest 27 is coming out this weekend. It's a lot going on and a lot to get to, so let's jump right into it. Again, this is Inside the Octagon podcast, which you guys can listen to every Monday evening from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This show is brought to you by the Sports Grid Podcast, which you guys can tune into every Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So be sure to check out the Sports Grid Podcast on Thursdays. Now, if you go back to this past weekend, we had UFC 210. Taking place in Buffalo, New York. Talk about a city that really needs some excitement going on there. The Bills have not been able to provide any of that in recent memory. Sorry, but it's true. But, oh man, this is the UFC's trip once again to New York City. New York City! And once again, they leave New York without clean slate. It has almost become tradition that if the UFC is in New York, we got to have some controversy. And if you look at Bellator coming to town later this summer, oh boy, that one should be a very interesting one. Although the New York State Athletic Commission is getting plenty of practice from the UFC. So hopefully for the next UFC event in New York and for the Bellator event in New York later on this year in June, it becomes more established, more well-rounded, more adapt to accommodating the mixed martial arts community and world and the event and getting things right. And some of you out there listening might say, well, Kalani, what are you talking about? What do you mean get things right? What is wrong with the New York State Athletic Commission? Well, one, you got to remember, MMA was just passed in New York just recently, last year. So they're not accustomed to treating MMA event as far as how to regulate them, observe them, and apply the rules. They're more used to boxing. And if you check out, for an example, this past Friday at the UFC 210 weigh-ins, you had Anthony Rumble Johnson making weight, and you had Daniel Cormier missing weight. Missing weight was a pound and a half over the 205 limit required for a title fighter. For a UFC title fight, in fact, I think it's for all of MMA, you have to be on the exact weight. Normally, there's always a pound accepted that you can be above. You could be a couple pounds below, but if you're 1 pound over, that's okay. But if it's a title fight, you have to be on whatever weight class you're fighting at. You have to be on point. So for Daniel Cormier, he had to be no heavier than 205. Now, he could have came in lighter if he so chose to, like Anthony Rumble Johnson did, who came in at 203 pounds. But for Daniel Cormier, he had to be at the most 205. He came in at 206.5. Walks off the scale. Okay, got it. It was for his first weigh-in. He gets on the scale, got a strip down. They put the towel up. Okay, didn't make it. So now I got to go back. 2 minutes later, DC comes back out, jumps on the scale. Towels are up because he had a strip down, makes 205. Why the hell did he lose 2 pounds or a pound and a half in 2 minutes? Well, the controversy was when Daniel Cormier stepped back on the scale the second time and he had to strip down his trousers and he had to stand there naked so they had the towels up. DC this time, second go around, puts his hands on top of the towels to balance himself out, almost as if to take some of the weight off. And sure enough, he comes in at 2 pounds. Now, there's YouTube videos out there, blogs out there, people who have pointed out how you can manipulate the scale by doing this simple technique. John Jones, who was doing an interview that day, said that it was one of the dirtiest tricks that he's ever seen done. This coming from a guy who likes the white girl, the white girl. You know what I'm talking about. So that was interesting coming from him. But other fighters complained. Other analysts pointed out. But nonetheless, we got the title fight that we sure have been waiting to see between DC and Rumble 2. Now, on to the actual fight. DC, Rumble, for the second time going at it. This time, there's no replacement. There's no late stand-in. The first time around last year, 2015, Rumble was supposed to step in the face. John Jones. He was supposed to step into the cage, square it up against John Jones. Jones gets in trouble with the law, obviously, and who emerges? Daniel Cormier. He says, I'll step in and I'll replace him. So the first time around, you could kind of understand why maybe Rumble couldn't get past. He was training for a tall, long, more of a stand-up fighter. Jones does have the wrestling background, and he does implement that type of fighting style into his game plans, but not necessarily like DC. Now he's taking on a short, stubbier, powerful, more wrestling-based fighter in Daniel Cormier, and DC was able to get the victory. This time around, okay, Rumble's had plenty of time to train for him. He's the only guy he's had to prepare for. Now, maybe, just maybe, we'll get a different outcome. We shall see. If you look at the first round, it certainly looked that way. Rumble came out doing his Fury punches. One of the scariest knockout artists out there, and throws a head kick that nearly took Daniel Cormier's head off. Right now, we don't have the reports as far as if DC's nose is broken, but he certainly said he believes it is. It was hurting him way after the bout as well when he was doing interviews, so there is something for that. But what was very interesting is Rumble had a more wrestling-based attack this time against DC, who's a two-time Olympian. Rumble was trying to initiate the grappling. He was trying to get takedowns. And really, this surprises everyone. Even Rumble's corner was saying, what are you doing? Stand up with this guy. If you guys remember last week on this episode, I told you, in order for Rumble to win, he would have to imply standing up, keeping his fight standing so he could utilize his power, and keeping distance. He doesn't want DC to get close to get his hands on him. Johnson is long. He's very versed in kicks. So you want to keep this fight. You want to circle around. You want to move. Kind of imply an Anderson Silva style of fighting where you're becoming a counterpuncher and you're waiting for your opponent to come in, leave an opening, and then you jump on it like a lion on a gazelle. Rumble did not do that. He said, nope, I'm going to take the fight straight to him. And even though people have been criticizing Anthony Johnson for this game plan, I actually want to say it's not bad. It's not as bad as people think, and here's why. DC knows that he's one of the best wrestlers in mixed martial arts. He knows he's a two-time Olympian. He knows outside of John Jones, there's really nobody that's going to try and take him down. Now, Alexander Gustafsson got a takedown, but Gustafsson was the same way. Even when he fought John Jones, that was something and he caught you by surprise with. You did not see that coming. He has not shown it in other matches. These two fights, he goes in, gets a surprising takedown. So I think Rumble, in his own mind, was thinking, okay, leading into this fight, DC has claimed, I don't hit as hard as people think. That even though I caught him the one time and nearly knocked him across the entire cage, that it was a mere slip-up. If you guys remember last week's podcast, I did go over how the knockdown came about. DC was already backing up. When Rumble connected with the overhand right, DC's back leg was already off the ground when he was shuffling back. So the momentum, the weight going back, being off balance, it led into DC falling back and down the way that he did, hence why he was able to get back up so quickly. So Rumble's like, okay, DC's saying that now he's going to stand up with me. DC, going into this fight, did several interviews where he said he'll gladly stand up with Rumble Johnson. He'll stand there and bang with him to show Rumble doesn't hit as hard as everyone thinks. So in Rumble's mind, he's thinking, okay, if DC is willing to stand and bang with me and he doesn't believe in my power, and he knows that everyone else knows how good of a wrestler he is, just maybe I could utilize my wrestling background. Johnson is a former junior college national champion. Maybe I could surprise him because he knows when I'm coming up. Think of this. Taking Anderson Silva, right? You take him on. You know Silva's going to tag you up on the feet. But what if Silva comes out and all of a sudden shoots in for a double leg takedown? It's like when Chuck Liddell finally fought Wanderlei Silva in the UFC when Silva finally came over after UFC bought Pride. And what happens in the third round? Chuck Liddell, totally out of character, goes for a takedown. Caught Silva by surprise. Caught everybody watching in attendance and live on pay-per-view by surprise. Caught Dana White by surprise. And really helped secure the victory for Chuck Liddell. And sure, Silva doesn't have the wrestling pedigree that DC has, but it's the surprise element, something you don't see coming. And I truly believe that's what Rumble was thinking of doing here, was saying, okay, let me go in here and really try to find a way to surprise DC. How am I going to do that? I'm going to go in for the takedown when he least expects it. If you remember when Anthony Rumble Johnson fought Dan Hardy many moons ago, he had the same game plan. Many people were excited for the matchup, the American taking on the Brit, two stand-up bangers, two knockout artists. Somebody's going to sleep. But then once the fight comes, Johnson implies his wrestling, something we had not seen in his MMA career. And all of a sudden, he's dominating Dan Hardy on the ground. Takedowns, control, positioning. Okay, not the most exciting way to go about it, especially given what everyone was expecting, but it got Johnson a W, which is most important. But unlike Hardy, and unlike Wanderlei Silva with Chuck Liddell, those guys were not two-time Olympians. They were not collegiate Division I All-Americans. They did not go to Oklahoma State, one of the best collegiate wrestling programs in all the world. It took place. DC was like, even though he probably was surprised when it first happened, he was like, okay, if this is where you want to go, wasn't my initial game plan for you, but if this is how you want to attack it, buddy, I'm more than happy to say, let's go. Hashtag embrace the grind. And DC, for, you know, again, leading into the fight, had said he's going to finish Rumble within two rounds. If you could withstand the 7-minute flurry of Anthony Rumble Johnson, you're going to be good. See, Johnson is one of those fighters that because of his power and because of his athleticism, he relies too heavily on it. When he can't utilize that against you, when he's pressed, when push comes to shove, when he meets resistance, he has been shown to not know how to react accordingly. Of course, the biggest example of that comes from when Johnson lost to a teammate of Daniel Cormier, Josh Koscheck. Koscheck, a wrestler. And Rumble, you know, he probably should have won because Koscheck faked and flopped on a knee when he was down, which did not connect, but he acted as if it did. Definitely should have won Best Supporting Actor. But nonetheless, when he was able to get his moment to recover, he goes in, he presses Rumble, grapples with him, takes him down, slaps on a rear naked choke. When DC slapped on the rear naked choke the first time, Koscheck was saying, I told you, I told you. His heart is made of fabric softener. And here, in the second round of this second fight, DC does the same thing. Gets him down, controls him very well on the ground. DC's jiu-jitsu game has jumped leaps and bounds in improvement. Scary factor, somebody with his wrestling pedigree and his strength now adding a high level of jiu-jitsu reminds me of a former UFC welterweight champion and Hall of Famer, Matt Hughes. Tremendous wrestling, incredibly strong, and now he's adding a deadly jiu-jitsu game to it. Watch out. And here DC gets the rear naked choke submission in the second round, defending his title once again. And not the fireworks show we thought we were going to get for a lot of people, not the outcome they thought they were going to get, but the 38-year-old Daniel Cormier says, hey, love me, hate me, doubt me, or root for me. Either way, it doesn't matter. I'm still and still the UFC light heavyweight champion. Now, I am going to try to see if I can get him on the show, but I did have a brief, and I do mean brief, conversation with one Luke Thomas on Twitter last week and talking about Daniel Cormier not being accepted by the fans, partially because he's a boring fighter. And I was for it. I agree. I felt that before this fight, Daniel Cormier is, his style is very effective and it's very good. But he's not someone that you say, I got to go back and watch this fight of his. Unless you're a true fan or unless you're doing some research or, I mean, if that's what you prefer, if his fighting style is what you prefer to watch, that's all fine and dandy. I'm not knocking you for that. But for the majority fan base, for the larger fan base, for the casual fans, Cormier in the cage is not necessarily somebody that you say, wow, that was an amazing fight. And here's the thing. His finishes can be amazing. Two submission victories over one of the most scariest knockout artists in all of combat sports. That's very impressive. But the journey to get there was not something to be remembered. And I look, again, I don't want to sound like one of these guys or one of these fans out here saying, I want every match to be a rock 'em, sock 'em, backyard brawl. If they're not bleeding, I'm not interested. No, 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 no. That is not my intentions. But what I am saying is, for every fighter, you have to have an it factor when you step in there. What is going to make us marvel at you? And what is going to captivate us about you? Look at the Diaz brothers. Not only is their attitude and demeanor outside the cage and some of their antics inside the cage things that draw fans' interest, but their fighting style keeps you wanting to watch them fight against nearly anyone. Win or lose, you want to tune in to see them because you know it's going to be entertaining. You know they're not going to back down, and you know they're going to come out there. And at any point in time, the high level of strikes to the body and combinations going upstairs, downstairs, or it's their high-level jiu-jitsu once it hits the ground, at any point in time, they can finish the fight or at least turn the momentum in their favor. Check Nate Diaz, Conor McGregor won. But for DC, he's going to have to take the path of one fighter that I mentioned earlier, Matt Hughes. Matt Hughes, early in his career, was not necessarily somebody that fans were being drawn to as far as, ooh, ah. But over time, people started to see, recognize, and respect his dominance. The fact that he wrestled better than everyone they saw at that time. The fact that he was stronger than everyone he faced. The fact that he utilized his wrestling, his strength, and his newfound jiu-jitsu skills to finish off opponents. And what are we starting to see DC do? Utilize his tremendous wrestling, his incredible strength, and his improved jiu-jitsu skills to go out and get victories. Now, to this idea that DC's not a boring fighter, before his John Jones fight at UFC 182 in the beginning of 2015, I want to ask you, of his then four UFC fights, how many do you go back and look at? His two fights at heavyweight, Frank Mir, Roy Nelson, decision victories, and they were unanimous decision victories for DC. Does anybody go back and watch those fights and are excited? No. Tough fighters for sure, especially Roy Nelson. You can't, it's very, very, very hard to finish him. Dude's got a chin, like cast iron chin. But you're not going back to watch either of those. The Patrick Cummings fight where he makes his light heavyweight debut, you let that go because Cummings stepped in the week of that and he was working a drive-thru at Starbucks, and then 6 days later, he's taking on DC. Okay, it's understandable. But even his fight against Dan Henderson, which he won, rear naked choke, in the third round of their bout, the highlights from that was the ultimate slam that he did. Almost looked like John Cena hitting the F5, or excuse me, the AA, as WWE's PG era doesn't want you to call it. In fact, you know what? One, it's called the AA. Okay? It's called the A, the Attitude Adjustment. It was originally called the FU. Now, I said the F5 because that's Brock Lesnar's finisher. So I do apologize for mixing that up right there, but you can see how close it is. Anyways, in fact, speaking of wrestling, boy, oh boy, this weekend, your boy was on the road, guys. Your boy was truly on the road. Saturday morning, wake up, hit the road to go to Reno. Leaving Vegas to go to Reno to check out very good friends of family, friends of the family, going up there to check out the son in a high school wrestling tournament. It wasn't for a school. It was one of those leagues that you're in, you know, away from the school, kind of like AAU. You know what I mean? Go up there to check it out in Reno. Make that seven and a half hour trip. Watch it. Impress. He did fairly well. He did fairly well. 1-1. Did good. A lot of good kids there. A lot of good athletes. Very, very much intense. I mean, you even had the girls who were wrestling. Man, oh, man. They looked like they were going to belly suplex somebody. I was waiting for one of them to hit an F5. But then leave Reno that same day after watching wrestling, grabbing a bite to eat after the event. Shot over to California, had to say what's up to the parents, went to Oakland. So from Reno to Oakland, so from Vegas to Reno to Oakland in one day, throwing between a wrestling event and dinner, that was my Saturday. Waking up Sunday morning, going from Oakland to Tracy, from Tracy down to 5, all the way back home here to Vegas. So basically, I did a 360. Vegas to Reno to Oakland, back to Vegas in less than 48 hours. Yeah, your boy definitely was putting some miles on the road this weekend. But anyways, back to D.C. I just had to throw that in there since we were talking about the wrestling. But back to D.C., the Dan Henderson fight. Outside of the AA that he hits on Dan Henderson, the highlights in there, there's really no highlights. I mean, he's got a trip in there, okay, where Henderson was backing up or at least moving away and DC tripped him from behind. But if you watch the fight, because I didn't see the fight live. When I saw the highlights, I was like, oh, man, not only did DC dominate, but this looks like a good fight. When I watch it, the highlights are like 4 minutes apart. I'm like, what the hell? The entire time, it's just DC laying on top of Henderson, holding position. And again, the finish is fine. The finish is good. It's a highlight. The journey is what's rough. It's like going from Vegas to Reno. The drive is rough. Your destination, get in there safely. That's something to remember. And for DC, hey, if he continues to finish off people, then he finished Dan Henderson, then he loses to Jones, but then he finishes off Rumble Johnson. He has an amazing fight against Alexander Gustafsson. He has a lackluster performance against Anderson Silva, who, to both of those men's credit, Silva stepped in the day before. And now he finishes off Anthony Johnson. So again, in DC's career, got a tremendous record at 19-1. Of his 19 wins, 12 have come by finish, 6 knockouts, 6 submissions, 7 decisions. If he continues to submit guys, even, you know, knocking guys out is always good, but even if you just go out there and you finish guys off, and it may not be the most exciting before the finish comes, but you go out there and continuously finish off fighters. Just like Matt Hughes, the fans will start coming around and saying, hey, it may not be the most tasteful. Might be a little bland, but you know what? It gets the job done. It gets the job done. Just like rice, some people like to add a little bit more to it for flavor, a little more style, a little more panache. If you're just having plain old rice, at the end of the day, it gets the job done. And that's what DC is. So, yes, I do believe that one of the reasons people do not get behind DC is his fighting style. Now, his other reason is, I think it's his personality. I heard earlier that it was, is DC overexposed? Because he does commentary, he does a UFC Tonight show, then he fights, so then you got, you know, the road to the octagon, the countdown, the interviews, etc., etc., and then the fight. I don't think it's overexposure, but I do believe it's his attitude, his personality. Because DC, I don't know if he's bipolar, but he's like Jekyll and Hyde. There's times where he will be funny, he will crack jokes, he will make light of the situation. Remember when John Jones last year came back, took on OSP, and when he was exiting the cage, he looks over at DC, gives him the finger, and DC just downplayed it. Why you got to be so mean, John? Why you got to be so mean? And it was funny. It was generally like DC was not overreacting to the moment. He embraced it and just said, it is what it is. We're not going to fight yet. Okay, guy. Okay. But when you listen to interviews, I mean, this was really interesting. The UFC countdown that came on last Sunday before, you know, this past weekend's fights. When you hear DC do interviews where he talks about how, you know, life for me has always been a struggle. I've always had to fight for what I want. And now that I have my kids and my family, and now I do this for them, I do this for my legacy. And I'm out here every day pushing myself, trying to get better in every aspect, trying to be a better all-around person. When you hear his interviews where he's just talking about himself and what he needs to do to become the best, it is something to root for. It is something to get behind. But then for some reason, I don't know what it is, when they put the microphone in front of him and he has to talk about other fighters, it's going to sound like I'm contradicting myself here, but DC comes off as, when he has to interact with the other fighters, he comes off as the high school jock bully. That's how he comes off. That's the attitude he gives off. Now, I only met DC once when he was fighting John Jones and they did an open workout and I got a picture with him. I was the last one before he left the open workout that he took a picture with before exiting the door. Real funny. Before me, it was a lady. He takes a smile. I asked him for one on him, say, good gosh. Now, granted, you know, I'm a male. He's tired, dehydrated. He's hungry. He's got to do all this. I get it. Didn't say it for the one with the titties, though. But I digress. But his personality, when I watch DC, it comes off as if he's somewhat of a jerk towards the other fighters. Now, of course, being athletes, being alpha males, that mentality, you're always testing each other. You're always trying to see who the big dog of the pack is. Who's the one in this group that, okay, that's the quote-unquote leader, so to speak. Who's the one, who's the top dog amongst us? But I don't know. I just feel that when you watch DC interacting with other fighters, he comes off as a bit of a jerk. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Conor McGregor, when he interacts with other fighters, outside of guys who obviously are not in his weight class or in a potential weight class that he could enter, it seems genuine. Like, hey, what's going on? What's happening? What's up? We've seen him with Chris Weidman, Yoel Romero, taking pictures, laughing, Ronda Rousey, even Cowboy Cerrone during a press conference when he was saying how in the back Conor McGregor was saying what's up to everybody. Then we get on stage, and now he's talking trash about everybody. DC comes off as somebody who he's laughing at you, not with you. That's how DC comes off. And look, I don't know him personally. I'm only going off of what I've seen, but that's the type of person DC comes off as. I'm laughing at you, not with you. And he does talk some trash, which is nothing wrong with that, but he does talk some trash at times where it comes off as, okay, dude, okay. And then, of course, the biggest reason that fans haven't gotten behind him is, well, he was kind of running his mouth like he was the best light heavyweight in the world when he won the title from against Anthony Romo Johnson when it was vacated. But he acted like just a couple of months earlier, we didn't see John Jones beat him pretty decisively, proving that he actually was the number one and best light heavyweight. And I think that's the problem. So many people were behind Jones that you can't get behind his natural enemy, which is DC. But I do believe, and we saw in this one, afterwards, DC was calling out Manoah, saying, boy, you don't want none of this. He was calling out Jones, saying, hey, if you're suspended, you're not allowed to play in the game, so I don't even want to talk about you. Get your shit together. And, when he was doing the interview for UFC Tonight, he did the Randy Orton pose. And I guess, he was saying that he's just not going to try to worry about who likes him and who doesn't. He's just going to be himself. Those that know him, they know what he's about. They know how he is, and it is what it is. And that's good. That's good. Chael Sonnen, Conor McGregor, to an extent, Ronda Rousey, all show the MMA world. If you can go out there and be captivating, use your personality, whether it's legit and true to who you are, or it's just a section, a piece of who you are, but it's emphasized 10 times over. This is the type of stuff people want. So I just think from a performance standpoint and from a personality standpoint, DC continues on this road with his actions in the cage. He'll win fans over. With his newfound attitude that he's shown after 2-10, if he continues along those lines, he'll win fans over eventually. The biggest thing for him is he's going to have to beat John Jones if he truly wants to win fans over. If he truly wants the fans to get behind him, he's going to have to beat John Jones, or at least push John Jones to the extent that Gustafsson did, where people are questioning who really won at the end of the fight. That's what DC's going to have to do. I guess Mawa. That's what DC's going to have to do. But the man that he beat, Anthony Johnson, surprised everyone. At 33 years old, retired from the sport of mixed martial arts. Said, yep, it's been fun. Getting punched in the face isn't something that, you enjoy, but you do it anyways. He even looked over at John Jones, said, I got no hate for you. I got nothing but love. Keep your head up. And I'm sorry we couldn't get the fans the fight that everyone wanted to see, which was Johnson and Jones. But he's going on to, I guess, greener pastures. There's been rumors out there circulating that possibly a role with the Los Angeles Rams. Johnson does have a slight football history. He's got a terrific build, 6'2", 6'2 and a half. Big guy when he doesn't have to cut down to 205. Big guy, walks around about 230, 235. Very athletic. So, look, being a player, I seriously doubt, considering, you got the NFL draft and you got guys who are playing football year-round and they're focusing on that and training for that, and they're younger and they're not getting a shot, and you're going to tell me a 33-year-old that probably has not played football for close to 15 years, all of a sudden he's going to get a chance at the NFL? Really? So it is going to be interesting to see what it might be. Could he be a trainer for the Los Angeles Rams? Very possible. Could he be somebody who comes in and has a role with them? Maybe a spokesperson doing some radio or doing some local TV, possibly. We shall see. It's only a rumor right now. But it is rumored that it has to do with football, and the Rams' names have been thrown around. If you check his Instagram, I don't know if it's still up. I haven't checked it today. But according to his Instagram, he had a lot of praise going out in different posts to the Los Angeles Rams. So maybe. But Anthony Johnson at 33 years old, deciding to walk away. Now, he is 33, so there is something to be said that maybe one day he comes back. Maybe one day he decides to say, you know what, whether this doesn't work out or I thought this would be good, but I miss fighting so much. I got the bug to want to go back in there. I'm fairly healthy and I'm still young. He can still get back in there. 22 wins, 6 losses. All his losses have come by stoppage, one knockout and five submissions. 16 of his 22 victories have come by knockout. He's either going to knock you out or it goes to decision. But 16 knockouts, and I mean brutal knockouts. Now, if he comes back, as I said last week, with Johnson losing twice now to DC, truly believe his only option, unless he's gone for a year and a half or 2 years, and there's a slew of new light heavyweight contenders that emerge, and they pass the Jimmy Manawals, they pass the OSPs, they pass the Gustafsons, and maybe DC moves on to heavyweight or retires, then, and Jones is still around, or if not, maybe he moves up. Maybe Rumble comes back. But honestly, I think a move to heavyweight is his future if he ever decides to do mixed martial arts again. He said that if he was to come back and have a fight against John Jones, heavyweight would be the ideal weight class for it. So I think it would have been a move with this loss that would have made perfect sense for him. He's fought a heavyweight before and was successful against Andre Arlovsky. He's got the power. He's got the youth. He's got the athletic ability to go out there and certainly make noise in the heavyweight division. So whatever Rumble is deciding to do with his career and with his life afterwards, hopefully he enjoys it. He loves it. He goes at it with all the passion. Hopefully he keeps his nose clean, head up, stays out of trouble, and does well in whatever he decides to do. More controversy. Now, the weigh-ins was the main event controversy, DC and the Towelgate, so to speak. Why now? And that's another thing. Why is everything now gate, spy gate, water gate, spy gate, deflate gate, towel gate? I can't get, are we not creative enough to come up with another way of going about how describing an incident? I understand the play on words, keeping it with, I get that. But Jesus Christ, towel gate, deflate gate, spy gate, water gate? Can we not come up with another phrase? I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I'm thinking, okay, this is just like the Michael Jordan tear face memes have gotten so old and ridiculous. Same thing with the gate scandals. Putting gate at the end of everything, it's getting old pretty quick. But be that nonetheless, the towel gate, oh gosh, that was for the main event. The actual event itself, the fights, that event was reserved for the co-main event to have its controversy. Gegard Mousasi defeats Chris Weidman via TKO by knees in the second round. But again, not by controversy. While Gegard Mousasi had Weidman in a front headlock. So Weidman obviously leaning forward, having his head, you know, Mousasi chest facing Weidman. But has Weidman bent over, puts him in a headlock. He throws a knee at Chris Weidman. At the time, Weidman had one hand down and was trying to put his second on the mat. But as his hand was going down, right before his hand touches the mat, Mousasi's knee lands. I mean, seriously, this is something straight out of Hollywood. It was so close. So that's the first knee. The second knee comes when Mousasi slightly turns to the left because Weidman is under his left arm in the headlock. So he slightly turns to the left, pulling Weidman's arm hand slightly off the canvas when he throws the second knee. Now Weidman goes down, it stopped, and the referee is thinking that these are illegal knees, that you're not allowed to knee opponent to the head when both hands are down on the mat. Okay, what's going on here? The referee outside the cage actually tells the referee in the cage, which is Dan Mergliotta, that it wasn't an illegal knee. Actually, it was legal because his hands was up. So Mousasi can't be disqualified because those were legal knees. So now he reverses his decision, saying, okay, it's not a disqualification. Weidman's hands weren't on the mat. It's good to go. Ring doctor comes in, observes Weidman, realizes that Weidman is unfit to continue, and next thing you know, okay, we got to call the fight. Now it goes from a disqualification for Mousasi to now a victory, a TKO for Mousasi. Now, plenty of people were saying that Weidman was milking the knees to the head. Unlike Koscheck, he actually took knees to the head, but he was actually milking it, trying to get the disqualification victory over Gegard. I'm not sure if this is the case for every state, but in the state of New York, you're now allowed to use video replay to change, or in this case, overturn your decision. So the outside referee, who I believe was Big John McCarthy, telling Dan Margliotta about the replay and the knees being legal instead of illegal, that shouldn't have happened. That shouldn't have taken place. But it did. But the New York State Athletic Commission let it slide because, again, they're not adapt to handling mixed martial art events. So now this takes place, and all right. And you're like, what the hell? So now, well, we thought Weidman was going to win by disqualification. Now he loses via TKO. You use replay, but you wasn't supposed to use it. It was illegal knees, but now they're legal knees. What the hell? Now, Musasi afterwards did say that if he would gladly give Weidman a rematch, considering, you know, this fight, this victory, even though it's his fifth one in a row, it's not really something that you're going to hang your hat on and go back to and say, yeah, look at that one, huh? How you like them apples? I mean, it is what it is. But he's got this victory now. As I said, it's fifth in a row. The way it turned out is not necessarily going to be one that jumps him to the front of the line for a shot at the middleweight championship. Considering how stacked the division is, he's probably one or two victories away from a title shot. The one victory is dependent on who it's against and how he does it. Now, there is a certain former UFC champion by the name of Anderson Silva who does need an opponent for UFC 212 in Brazil. I'm saying like Vin Diesel from Fast Five. Brazil. So, with Kevin Gastelum failing an out-of-competition drug test for marijuana, there needs a replacement. Now, I did read that Luke Rockhold volunteered and said he's willing to step in. That'll be an interesting one. Two former champions going at it. Musasi has long wanted a matchup against the Spider. Maybe Musasi takes it if, obviously, he doesn't have any physical damage. You know, maybe gets re-examined or re-evaluated, hand, a knuckle, a foot, a shin, whatever. No injuries, maybe he steps in. And if he can step in against Anderson Silva, and let's say he wins, now he's being Vitor Belfort, Weidman, and Silva, three former champions. That could now put him in contention to be the number one contender for the middleweight championship after Yoel Romero. Jacare is the number two, but we'll talk about where he stands at a little bit later in the show. So for Gegard Mousasi, good win, not necessarily something that, you know, we're all going to look back on and talk about in full length, but definitely controversial to say the least. But this also goes into the notion of fighters trying to use rules. How can I word this? Fighters trying to play to use the rules to benefit them. And some, just like the old saying goes, sometimes when you play with fire, you're bound to get burned. And when you're trying to manipulate the rules, that's what I was looking for, manipulate. When you try to manipulate the rules into your favor, sometimes the ball doesn't land on your side of the court. And that's what happened here with Chris Weidman. Now, I'm not knocking him for putting his hands down because that's going to take away knees coming to the head. But it does say, what would have been better? Trying to put your hands down on the ground so you don't take a knee, or keeping your hands up and guarding yourself and maybe trying to find another way to get out of danger like that. Now, of course, Musasi's tough, 31 years old, 50 fights, a lot of experience, very good background, well-trained fighter, get that. But, you know, these cases where athletes are trying to manipulate the rules, and we see it in football, we see it in basketball, we see it in every sport. You try to manipulate the rules, you know, you try to get somebody to get called for a foul or a penalty, something to go in your favor. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And in this case, it didn't work out for Chris Weidman. And for Weidman, the former middleweight champion, you got to wonder, where does he go from here? 3 losses in a row now. He lost his title to Rockhold at UFC 194. He loses to Yoel Romero at UFC 205. And now this loss right here. All 3 came by way of stoppage as well. Now, what's interesting about Weidman's 3-fight losing streak is how close he was to winning every fight. His matchup against Rockhold, he had the knee injury and Rockhold had a staph infection, or was the other way around. But both fighters had their issues going into the fight. But it was fairly competitive. It wasn't one-sided. It wasn't like Rockhold was dominating it. No, Weidman was holding his own. But up until the third round, halfway through the third round, when he throws a spin kick, again, trying to catch a fighter off guard with something he's never seen from you, Vitor Belfort did the same thing, and it worked on Rockhold, it worked on Bisping, and it worked on Henderson. So, again, can't really knock Weidman for trying to throw something new out there. It worked for Junior Dos Santos against Mark Hunt. So, okay, but when he missed, that now opened up the door for Rockhold to take him down, mounts him. Rockhold, an excellent jiu-jitsu practitioner. Weidman being a terrific wrestler. Wrestlers are not good off their backs. They're like turtles, just not good off their backs. He loses that fight. Okay. The one mess up is what causes downfall. Okay. Then he takes on Yoel Romero at 205, first event in New York. And he's doing fairly well. In fact, you probably could say he was up 2-0 over Romero in the third. Got some takedowns, held him down. Romero had his moments as well, but you could say it was a close fight, 1-1 or 2-0 Weidman. But then Romero, with his explosiveness, his athletic ability, and his power, hits Weidman with a flying knee, knocks him out, puts him away. Tough break. But okay. I just got caught. He wasn't dominating me. He wasn't bullying me. It wasn't like every punch he hit me with, I was just taking 3 steps back. No, I just got caught. Okay, fair enough. Now this loss to Musasi. And again, hey, I took 2 knees that I thought were illegal. He even told Joe Rogan afterwards in a post-fight interview, he thought he got hit with illegal knees. Rogan pulls up the replay and shows actually they were perfectly legal. And Weidman kind of got stuck there and just said, well, all right then. And that was his argument. And when he was shown video evidence, he really had nothing behind it, which is fine. It's right after a fight. But again, it's not like he's just being beaten up or dominated by these guys. It's one thing slipping. A missed spin kick. A flying knee. Knees to the unprotected head when he was trying to put his hands down. And now we're questioning, is Weidman still an elite middleweight? Many people question Weidman's legitimacy early on when he first beat Anderson Silva for the middleweight championship due to the fact that he was inexperienced. He didn't have all these fights. Weidman, at 32 years old, he only has a total of 16 fights. And when he fought Anderson Silva the first time, it was his 10th fight. So you're challenging the greatest middleweight and arguably the greatest MMA fighter of all time with only 9 MMA bouts, 9 victories? So you got to wonder, was it just too much too soon for Weidman? Leading up to it, you know, his head coach, Ray Longo, has spoke about how they got complacent. You know, they even admit, okay, yeah, we got complacent. We got to find that hunger again. We got to find that fire back. Sounds like Rocky III, right? When he lost to Clubber Lane, he became, you know, he got civilized. He lost the hunger. He lost the edge. He lost the eye of the tiger. Cheap plug. A little corny, maybe, but who doesn't love Rocky, right? But it's the same thing with Weidman. And then he goes on to say that, you know, he almost was contemplating whether he should move back in with his parents because now he's got the big house. He's got, you know, nice ride. He's providing for his family. And I use the same quote again. It's the same thing former boxing middleweight kingpin Marvin Hagler said. It's hard to get out there and train for a boxing fight when you're waking up and getting out the bed in silk sheets. It's hard for that. That's why it was so amazing what Floyd Mayweather was able to do. the lavish lifestyle he lived and still was able to go out there and bust his tail in training to go to 49-0. Will it be 50-0? Will it be 49-1? We'll see. But for Weidman, he was suffering the same fate. And again, maybe not on the same level, but you got to understand, everybody comes from different beginnings, different backgrounds, and different starting points. I mean, you're talking about somebody who I believe at one point was living in the basement of his parents' house. And now he goes from living in the basement to now having his own basement, his own man cave, several rooms, his own yard, front and back. It's success. Hey, I've done it. I've gotten where I wanted to be. And this is why you have to get credit to fighters such as Conor McGregor, for a moment in time, Ronda Rousey, John Jones even. The fact that they're getting everything that they ever wanted from this sport, riches, fame, houses, cars, jewelry, all of it. And for a period of time, they were still unstoppable. Now, Rousey obviously had her collapse. McGregor had his hiccup loss against Nate Diaz, but he avenged it later on. Hopefully, we'll see a third match between those two. But for John Jones, came out of nowhere. Here's a guy who had to leave college because his girlfriend at the time got pregnant, and he needed to stop wrestling, stop going to school, and get a job to provide for his family. Was a bouncer at one point, started the MMA, climbed to the UFC ranks at an ungodly speed, right? Becomes the youngest UFC champion, defends it against future Hall of Famers, former champions, and does it in a fashion that no one's ever seen before. Now, of course, he suffered from some of his own demons, getting the best of him, finding himself in, you know, bad circumstances. Okay. But now we're looking at that with Weidman, and we're saying, okay, is this guy still elite? Is he still one of the best middleweights out there? Was he a guy who, given his fight style and given just the stars and the moon aligning, you know, as they always say, for every great warrior, sooner or later, somebody's got your number. You just got to hope to be on top long enough. Mike Tyson, it was Buster Douglas. For Anderson Silva, it was Chris Weidman. Now, that doesn't mean Weidman isn't a tremendous fighter. He is. But is he an elite fighter? Or was he just someone who benefited from catching Anderson Silva at the right time, right place, and had the right fighting style and tools that could beat Anderson Silva? Hard to say. Hard to argue against it. Because after he beat Silva twice, he goes on to beat Lyoto Machida. He goes on to beat Vitor Belfort. And you could look at those and say, well, Silva's getting old. You can say that the Weidman fights was really the first sign of his downfall. The second one, he broke his leg. The first one, he got caught, you know, showboating. So, okay, it's not like, even though Weidman was winning both matches, in fact, in the second one, Weidman dropped Silva in the clinch when he hit him with an overhand left, and Silva's eyes actually rolled to the back of his head. And if it wasn't for Silva having a Muay Thai clinch on him and dragging Weidman down, Weidman could have postured up and utilized ground and pound to finish off the spider. But then with Machida, some were saying that he was starting to fade towards the end of the fight. You can see it in the fourth round. But Machida is also older, doesn't necessarily have, you know, he doesn't have it like he did in his prime. Belfort, obviously, of course, is older. And once you get past that first wave of punches that Vitor throws at you, he's another one that's been shown to fold. So you look at that and you say, well, even though he was very impressive, maybe there were some signs that we weren't seeing. Kind of like with Ronda Rousey. As easily as she made her opponents look in the cage, there were times where you see signs that if she gets matched up against somebody, it's going to be bad. The second Miesha Tate fight, the first one in the UFC, Tate was showing you that when I hit this girl in the face, she doesn't like it. She doesn't know how to respond. But what was happening? I kept charging in, looking for a takedown, and she just threw me in her judo throw. Liz Carmouche, Ronda Rousey's very first fight, the first women's fight in the UFC, nearly submits her. If you look at other fights, you take away the ones who just tried rushing her. Look at her stance. Look at her elbow spacing. Look at the type of punches she was throwing, the bad technique and the bad form. And you're starting to say, you know, if she could just take on somebody who has the tools that is a kryptonite for her, it's going to be lights out. Holly Holm, Amanda Nunes. Now you're looking at Weidman and you're saying, what happens when he doesn't face a fighter who's on a downside of their career, who isn't over the top, who isn't old and doesn't have it anymore? Rockhold, Romero, and Musasi have shown, So it is interesting to see how things with one Chris Weidman are going to turn out. I, for one, think that he should consider moving up to light heavyweight. I believe I talked about this a couple times on this year's show. And if you guys also check out my sports page on Facebook, All Things Sports, article coming tomorrow is going to be up about it. But with a light heavyweight division being what it is, without John Jones, Ryan Bader, Phil Davis leaving, other prospects being dropped, and now you look at Rumble leaving, there's a big opening in that division for one or two of the bigger middleweights to move up and say, hey, I'm going to be at the top of this division sooner rather than later. I'm not necessarily going to start from the bottom. So, yeah, I think for Weidman, three losses in a row, and the way that he's done it and as stacked as that division is, it might take him a while before he can climb that ladder again. Maybe a move up to light heavyweight could be in order for him. He's still young. Of course, he's got to get his body healthy because he's dealt with injuries multiple times in his career. But if he can do that, maybe this could light another fire under him as far as he's in a new division, new opponents, new opportunities. It's very, very likely that this can happen. DC's a wrestler as well. Maybe if things don't work out with Jones, maybe we get Weidman in DC in the future. So that would be interesting. Oh, boy. I'll tell you, at one point in time, Weidman was certainly looked at as, could this be the next great American fighter? And now we're wondering, is he even an elite fighter anymore in a division? You also got to ask the question for not just Weidman. Of course, in this situation, it's very relevant. But for fighters that lose a fight, especially in knockout fashion, or spectacular fashion, because a submission could be just as deadly. Should they do what boxing does and have a tune-up fight? Boxing, it gets criticized a lot for it, but I do believe it's one of the ways that it is slightly better than the UFC in this regard. You go out there and you lose a fight, especially by knockout, your next fight, you're not taking on one of the top guys. You're taking on somebody else who's just a peg down the ladder from you. Or a few pegs, for that matter. Just depends. But that's how it works out. We got to get you that tune-up fight. If you've been gone for a long period of time or you suffered a devastating finish, we're going to give you a tune-up fight. Somebody who you would have a better chance of going against and being successful rather than throwing you in there with the wolves. In the UFC, there is no easy fights. There is no, gimme fights. Everything is tough and it's a grind. But then also you're saying, gosh, are we just getting rid of some of our better fighters too quickly? When Manny Pacquiao got knocked out by Juan Manuel Marquez in 2012, his next fight was against Brandon Rios. Now, no offense to Brandon Rios. He's not on the level of a Juan Manuel Marquez, a Floyd Mayweather, a Manny Pacquiao. He's not in that class. But it's something to allow the Filipino superstar to be able to say, okay, let me see if I still got it. And it gives me a chance to go out there and really, you know, build my confidence back up, get back on the horse and show not only my fans, my supporters, my doubters, my critics, but also myself that I'm still one of the better fighters. Because if I go out there and I smoke this guy, then I believe in myself and saying, I can do it. In the UFC, you don't get none of that. For Weidman, how good would he have benefited if, after the Romero knockout, if he would have had a tune-up fight in the middleweight division? Somebody outside the top 10, somebody, you know, outside the top 12, probably would have benefited a lot. You would have went in there and been able to say, hey, I got a good victory against a quality opponent, building my confidence back up. And, you know, even when he lost to Luke Rockhold, now he was due for a rematch because he was a champion but got injured right before UFC 199. But then he wants to be on a New York card in Madison Square Garden at 205. He says, yep, I'm going to take on Romero. Sure, I'll take him on. Really? You want to take on a guy that deadly? Okay. Didn't work out for him. So now for Weidman and really any other fighter that suffers a devastating finish, you got to wonder, why not give these guys 2-0 fights? Only one. We're not asking, you know, for you to just grab a CM Punk or somebody off the street and just put in. No, but give, you know, depending on the ranking, give them somebody that you 5, 6, 7 spots below them in the ranking. Somebody that could be competitive, but also somebody that they can get a good victory over, build their confidence up, get them back on the right track and say, okay, I'm back. Because now with this loss, with these three losses to these three opponents, now you look at it and say, there's no way in the world, even with 2 victories or 3 victories, that Weidman should be back in the middleweight title picture unless injuries, suspensions, devastating knockouts by one guy just running through division. If Romero goes in there and knocks out Bisbee, knocks out the next guy, if he does that, then okay, maybe you could say Weidman, but he's already got a knockout victory over him. So the tune-up victories in mixed martial arts certainly should be something to be considered, and it will help these fighters have a little more longevity production-wise for the promotion. Because then you could now build Chris Weidman off of this last his next victory, and then going forward and then going forward until he gets back to the elite status. Now you got to wonder, oh boy, outside of a fight night card, I don't know if we could justify putting you in the main or co-main event spot. Unless it's a fight night card or it's in New York. And yeah, a fight night card in New York, yeah. But a pay-per-view, unless it's a very weak card, no sirree. No sirree. We'll see if Weidman decides to stay in the middleweight division. I personally think he needs to move up to the light heavyweight division. Women's strawweight fight that took place. Cynthia Calvillo got an impressive victory via rear naked choke in the third round over UFC newcomer Pearl Gonzalez. This fight has some controversy as well because initially Pearl Gonzalez was taken off the card due to the New York State Athletic Commission saying, yeah, she's had breast implants, so no bueno, can't go. UFC and the Athletic Commission talked it out, shake on it, she's back on the card. And I'm sure for Pearl Gonzalez, obviously this is not how she wanted to make her UFC debut, and of course this is not how she wanted her personal life and personal business to be known to the public. But it is what it is. She did a very good job in an interview process before the fight, leading up to it for media day, in addressing it, owning it, and really kind of made it a non-issue. We'll see if, you know, if it comes up again in the future. I doubt it, unless you got those ignorant fans out there, which they exist, that bring it up, or a fighter who just wants to throw some shade with the trash talking. But other than that, you know, it wasn't a big deal, really. Don't hear much about it Sunday or today as far as it being mentioned. So, you know, good for her for being able to own it and put it behind her. Lesson learned for any fighter or any athlete that gets into any kind of controversy. The sooner you own it and the sooner you face it, the sooner all the rest of us can put it behind. Because now it becomes old news. But you keep wanting to deny, push it off to the side and act like it didn't happen, the more it's going to be brought up because we want answers. But for Cynthia, this was a very good, impressive win for her. This is something, again, for her to build off of and to say, hey, the 29-year-old is starting to look pretty impressive. 5-0. 4 of her victories have come by finish, 2 knockouts, 2 submissions. And now you look at it in the UFC, all 5 of her wins have been in the UFC, and she looked pretty good. Pretty good. Excuse me. She's 5-0. 2 of her wins have been in the UFC. I looked at a record when the rest of the page loaded up. I'll tell you, but both of her victories, Amanda Cooper and now Pearl Gonzalez, both by rear naked chokes. So, you know, for Cynthia, this could be something to say, okay, let's get her a couple more fights where we start building her up. Now, hopefully they learn their lesson from the Paige Van Zandt of we want to market her, but we don't want to blow her up and put her in main event spots just yet. We don't want her in co-main event spots just yet. Let's take our time and let's start saying, hey, let's slowly build it with Paige. I think the writing might have been on the wall that as much as she loves fighting, as attractive as she is and as good of a personality as she has, there are going to be way too many other options for her sooner rather than later. She just jumps out at the public's eye whenever she's on screen. So as much as she loves fighting, and she does, Paige is going to get so many offers from television, from movies, from possibly a place like the WWE to come and do spots. It's sooner or later going to become too much for her to turn down. Same thing with Ronda Rousey. As much as she loves fighting, Hollywood came calling, the WWE came calling, and it became too much for her to turn down. But now you look at Cynthia, not to say that she's not an attractive woman, I'm not saying that at all, but let's be honest, there's different levels of attractiveness. George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Ryan Gosling, I mean, it is what it is. Mekhi Pfeiffer, Blair Underwood, Denzel Washington, it is what it is. Benjamin, you know, you get what I'm saying. Jennifer Lopez, Holly Berry. It's different levels of attractiveness. So it's the same thing here for Cynthia. She's an attractive woman, but she's not going to be grabbed right now. And again, if the UFC does the right job and not throw all the promotion behind her, they can hold on to her for just a little bit longer. They threw behind Paige so quickly because of her attractiveness, because of that smile, because of her fighting style, which was so aggressive, because of her personality. They knew, one, that can all be attractive, but they also knew once people see her, the calls are going to start coming in. So we got to try to get behind her as much as possible now to try to keep her happy and to keep her here and to max out what we can from her now until she decides to leave. And I believe Paige just won the celebrity version of Chopped, or at least made it to the finals. I don't know if they got to do another round, but I did read that she won that, or at least looked to win it. She did Dancing with the Stars. Rumors of the WWE possibly wanting her this summer for SummerSlam. So, but you look at Cynthia and you say, wow, very impressive, very good. And you're doing it in a division that's so growing, getting more and more popular. We're seeing more and more contenders come out each and every event, it seems like. So this is something for Cynthia Cavillo to definitely build off of going in the future and to say, okay, even though this was a newcomer, this was more so for me to show you guys I'm legit, I'm here to stay, and I'm only going to get better. For Pearl Gonzalez, even though it's her debut, no shame, no shame. Brock Lesnar lost his UFC debut. Liddell lost one of his early fights in the UFC. Matt Hughes lost one of his early fights in the UFC. No shame. Keep your head up. Continue to go out. Continue to get trained. Continue to get better. She's another one. Very good smile. Owned it on the interview. So she definitely has the confidence, not only in the cage, but on the mic, to, hey, if I mess up, it is what it is. Attractive young lady. So she's someone the UFC is going to say, oh, we're keeping you around. You and Cynthia, y'all probably going to meet again somewhere in the future. When you get better, you're probably going to meet again somewhere in the future, and we're going to run this back. Thiago Alves gets a victory in returning to the welterweight division after he tried to make a run at the lightweight division. No go. And defeating Patrick Cote via unanimous decision. Afterwards, Cote, like Johnson, decided to retire and walk away from the sport of mixed martial arts. And oh, man, it was a good showing for Alves. Certainly showed that, okay, the pit bull, he might be back. He might be, excuse me, might be someone to say, okay, a couple of decent victories like this, now we can start talking about, all right, is he going to decide to, can he get back in the welterweight title to picture? It's very possible. It's been a while, but it's still possible. He's still young enough to do it, still has a skill set, still very powerful. He's only 33 years old. So if he could just get his diet and nutrition correct and himself to make 170 like he used to have to do in the past, it's very possible that he can make a nice run. For Cote, here's a fighter who at one point in time fought Tito Ortiz at light heavyweight, fought Anderson Silva for the middleweight championship, but unfortunately blew out his knee in the third round, I believe. I mean, he's been in there with a who's who in the MMA world and just decided to say, you know what, it's time for me to walk away. Only 37 years old, of course, in the welterweight division. And you can say that's a little up there, but it's not dramatically up there. But Alves, Cerrone, Ben Saunders, Josh Berkman, Joe Riggs, Stephen Thompson, Kyle Nook, Kung Lee. Anderson Silva, Ricardo Almeida, Kendall Grove, Scott Smith, Travis Luter, Jason McDonald, Chris Lieben, Tito Ortiz. He's been there with the who's who in the mixed martial arts world. So it was an excellent career, a long one, very, very successful, 23-11. Unfortunately, though, he lost his last two to Cerrone and Alves and just says, hey, I'm 3-3 in my last six. I think it's time for me to walk away and go on and do other things. More power to him. Best of luck to him going forward. Charles Oliveira, making his UFC lightweight debut, gets the victory over Will Brooks via submission, rear naked choke in the first round. Will Brooks, somebody who came in from Bellator, had a lot of hype behind him, but now this is his second loss. Something to really put him back. His next fight, hey, you're always one fight away from going up or going down. So hopefully for Will Brooks, he can bounce back. For Oliveira, looks good. Has missed weight consistently at the featherweight division, but afterwards said that he wants to go back to 145. He's got the right people around him now to get him where he needs to be, and is choosing to go down to 145. I don't know. Maybe it was spur of the moment, emotions, or maybe he's right. Maybe the nutritionists, the trainers, and the coaches he's got around him now are going to do better by his side and can get him to be more focused and motivated and more disciplined to make the weight consistently. We'll see, but maybe he needs to take a note page from Kevin Gastelum. Moving up to a better weight class where you don't have to kill yourself to make weight, you could probably be more successful in that regard. Miles Jury defeated Mike Della Torre via TKO in the first round from elbows and punches. Kamaru Usman, the Ultimate Fighter winner, defeated Sean Strickland by decision. Patrick Cummings defeated Jan Blachowicz by decision. So, pretty good fight. Pretty good fight. So far, Desmond Green defeated Josh Emmett. Pretty good fight card. You know, nothing to blow you away with, but it was a good fight card. Some good fights, some good performances, good storylines coming out of it. So, UFC 210 delivered. Had some fighters call it a career. Had some fighters show that maybe we're not title challengers just yet, but we're certainly in that upper echelon class, like a Gegard Mousasi class, and I look pretty good. So if I decide to stick it out here, watch out, Oliveira. I'm back in my weight class, and even though I took on a fighter who just retired, maybe this could be the jumpstart I need to make a fresh run in this division, Alves. And hey, I'm still young in my career and young in my run in the UFC, but I'm here to really make some noise, Cynthia. So it's definitely going to be fun to see where these fighters from this card go from here and what the future holds for them. This coming weekend, we have UFC Fight Night on Fox coming to you from Kansas City, Missouri. Headlined by one, Demetrius Johnson defending his title against Wilson Reyes. Demetrius Johnson has 9 successful title defenses. Anderson Silva holds the record with 10. If Demetrius Johnson wins, he ties the record. He does it again, he's the all-time record holder. And how fitting is it that he's going to tie and hopefully break a record in the same, well, he's going to tie a record in the same month that Russell Westbrook of the NBA tied and broke Oscar Robertson's 50-plus year record of triple-doubles in the season. 42 triple-doubles in the season. It was previously held by Robinson at 41, and averaging a triple-double for a season. Robinson was the last man to do that in 61-62. Russell is now doing that in 16-17. It's a year of record-breaking. So for Demetrius, he's certainly going to look for that record against a man in Wilson Reyes who he was supposed to fight last year, but the fight ended up being called off due to Demetrius being injured, something we do not see regularly, but he is a dangerous, dangerous fighter. 22-6, 10 wins via submission. He trains under Alliance MMA with the last match to Demetrius Johnson and Dominic Cruz. So he is somebody that you have to be on the lookout for and say, okay, this guy could be a legit threat to Mighty Mouse, who is the UFC king down there at the flyweight division. In the co-main event, we have the women's strawweight division, Rose Namajunas taking on the karate hottie Michelle Waterson. This is for the women's strawweight number one contenders bout. Jessica Andrade is taking on Joanna Jędrzejczyk later on this year. The winner of Namajunas versus Waterson gets the next title shot. So whether it's Joanna retaining her title or Jessica dethroning the champion, if she dethrones her, not quick knockout, dominating fashion, or quick submission, if it's a dominating victory, then Namajunas or Waterson are probably going to be the next ones to get a title fight. If Jessica Andrade somehow does beat Joanna in a close contested fight, expect Joanna to get her immediate rematch. Therefore, Rose or Michelle would have to wait. But this is going to be a good fight right here. Two women who are very versed in the stand-up game, obviously karate hottie, that's where she likes to keep it. But both have shown in the past, Namajunas against Paige VanZant, Michelle Waterson in her last outing. Another one against Paige VanZant, showing that their grappling is coming up as well, that they are legit grapplers, that they will certainly bring you down to the ground and dominate you there. Now, I do believe that the grappling advantage would go to Rose Namajunas if they were to tangle up in that fashion and go to the ground. So there is that aspect of it right there. Will Namajunas look to take this down to the ground as quick as possible? She has a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, while Michelle Waterson is only a blue belt. But Waterson does train at Jackson Wink MMA in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Tremendous wrestling coaches there and tremendous wrestlers there and grapplers there as well. So even though her ranking may not be as high, she certainly has the experience of training with and against some of the best grapplers with the coaches in the world out there. So that should be a good one. The number two middleweight in the UFC, Jacare Souza, decides, I'm not going to wait to see what happens with Romero and Bisping and the UFC title. I want to stay active. He is taking on very, very dangerous Robert Whittaker. Whittaker, the young knockout artist, coming in looking to get the biggest feather under his cap with a win over Jacare to say, you know what, I'm 26 years old from New Zealand, and I'm looking to come in here and make a name for myself. He's already doing so with 17 wins, 8 knockouts, 15 submissions, but he's saying, you know, I'm on a 6-fight win streak. I've defeated Uriah Hall, Brad Tavares, Derek Brunson in my last outing. I'm looking to continue this, make it 7 in a row against the biggest name on my resume so far. So it is definitely something that Robert Whittaker is looking to show, that he deserves to be in that elite category of the MMA fighters. For Jacare, he's saying, 17 of my 24 victories have come by way of submission, and I'm looking to go for hopefully not only my 25th win by submission. And you know what? Even though my loss in 2015 to Yoel Romero is my only one in the UFC, I'm on a 2-fight win streak now. I'm right there in title contention. And before my loss to Yoel Romero, I was on a 3-6. I was on a 8-fight win streak. That loss to Romero is very controversial. So, yeah, I'm looking to go out there and make a name for myself, but to prove to people I'm the rightful challenger for that middleweight championship. So Jacare choosing to be active instead of sitting on the shelf and waiting to see how the middleweight title picture plays out. Bisping is supposed to fight GSP, but GSP wants to fight in the fall. Bisping wants to fight in the summer. Bisping says if the fight doesn't happen in the summer, then he'll fight Romero. We'll see how it all plays out. If Jacare could go in there and get a very impressive victory over Whittaker in fantastic highlight reel fashion, I don't know if it'll jump him over Romero, because Romero holds a victory over him. You never know. It will certainly mean that if Romero does end up getting a shot at Bisping, Jacare needs to be ready and stay in shape in case Romero ends up having to drop out via injury, which he most likely wouldn't, but you never know. Jeremy Stephens is going to be on the card taking on Rento Moicano, O-I-C-A-N-O. Okay. Bobby Green is going to be on the card as well. Very good fighter. Tremendous story, backstory there with him. But he's going to be taking on Rashid Magomedo. Wait, fighter to watch. He's going to be taking on Luis Smoker. That should be a very good fight. Aljamain Sterling is back. He's going to be looking to get back in the win column as he's taking on Augusto Mendez. We got Ashley Evans-Smith taking on, she's taking on Keaton Veria. Zach Cummings is fighting Nathan Coy and many other fights as well. This is a pretty good fight card. It's one of the best UFC on Fox cards we've seen. We got one of the greatest, if not arguably the best pound for pound fighter in the world right now, Demetrius Johnson, taking on a very tough and game Wilson Reyes. We got two of the best women strawweight fighters in the world going at it for a number one contender's bout. We got an elite middleweight contender taking on a very, very scary middleweight. Another one of the hardest hitters in the featherweight division, Jeremy Stephens. We got Bobby Green, Tim Elliott, Aljamain Sterling, Ashley Evans-Smith, Zach Cummings. So it is a lot of good fights and a lot of good fighters to check out. So be sure to check out UFC on Fox April 15th from Kansas City, Missouri, from the Sprint Center. That should be a good one indeed. Now, as we're wrapping up the show here, we still got some time left. So had to get some water real quick as I make the final run. I wanted to talk about real quick. This idea of fighters and weight cutting. I know we've talked about this ad nauseum, but what I mean is, you know, when we saw in his last fight, DC said that this was arguably the toughest weight cut he's ever had to do. Now, he did say, hey, I'm 38 years old, but I also didn't keep myself in the type of shape I need to be in during the offseason. He was out for a while. He had a groin injury, so he couldn't do as much cardio that he probably could have beforehand. And, you know, when you got the new contract, you're the champion, you're doing the commentating and the analysis, you're enjoying life a little bit. Rumble obviously has had his big history of having problems with weight. Charles Oliveira moving up to a new weight class. Thiago Alves coming back to a new weight class. And I just don't understand. Like, I understand the mindset. I understand the thinking, but I don't understand the mindset of where's Weidman maybe needing to move up to light heavyweight. I don't understand the mindset of fighters killing themselves to get down to a lower weight class if they are struggling to make that weight. Charles Oliveira is somebody who has missed weight, I believe, six times in his career and still wants to go back down to featherweight. DC, if it wasn't for his loss to John Jones, he probably would have been moved up to heavyweight. If it wasn't for Anthony Johnson being in the elite category, he might have moved up to heavyweight. Weidman probably needs to move up to light heavyweight. For so many of these fighters, I understand that you want to be bigger than your opponent. You want to have as many advantages as you possibly can. But whether it's the fighter, the fighters aren't going to get smart on themselves. The UFC and the MMA hierarchies need to get together and they need to figure out ways to make the and they need to make it more attainable where fighters are fighting at their more natural weight classes. Again, adding more weight classes and adding a stipulation that for the day of the fight, you can't rehydrate past X amount of pounds, let's say 10 pounds. So if you're fighting at 185, can't go above 195 the day of the fight. Now that could cause some problems because, well, what happens if somebody goes up and they are 196, 197, 198? Do they get pulled from the card? You could say that they're pulled from the card or a percentage of their purse now is going to go to their opponent. You could say that they now have disqualified themselves from any performance bonus and 20% of their purse is going to now go to their opponent. You could say that, and maybe that could be an incentive, but there certainly needs to be something weight cutting. And also one thing I want to talk about was Demetrius Johnson is going after history right now. He's going after the Thai history. And he is somebody who does not nearly get the credit, respect, admiration, and appreciation from the fans that he should. And but unlike Daniel Cormier, you got to wonder, why is it? He doesn't have a bad personality. He doesn't treat people bad. He doesn't talk down about opponents. He seems to be one of the nicest people in this sport that you'll ever run into. He smiles. He talks to everyone. He answers questions. When people try to talk trash to him, he kind of like plays it off, plays it down, doesn't really buy into it. He goes on Twitch so that he can interact with his fans through video games. And he has shown, hey, I'm a tremendous fighter. Of my 25 wins, 14 event finishes. Now, I do have 11 decisions, but I'm also 125 pounds. But I do wonder, is it Demetrius Johnson or is it just the fact that he is 125 pounds? What I mean by that is, even look at boxing. Their biggest stars don't start until they get to the 140, 147-pound division. Now, granted, those divisions tend to be more stacked. When you start getting there, you start seeing more guys who have better power. But I also think it's because those guys look like average people for the most part. Obviously, if you're Polynesian, that's not average unless you're, 11. But, the little guys in boxing don't get the same credit. And here in MMA, these guys don't get the credit that they should. Dominique Johnson's last loss was in 2011. Then he had a draw against Ian McCall. But since then, he has gone to win 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 fights in a row. 10 of them, being with the title on the line. And if you want to say, well, it's because he always goes to decisions and he doesn't finish guys. During his title run, he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 victories by finish. So, yes, it may not be all the time and it may not be consistent, but Demetrius Johnson is one of the greatest fighters you will ever see. He does everything right, has very few holes in his game outside of taking on a bigger opponent like Dominic Cruz. Quick, fast, cardio for days. Good power, good grappling, good stand-up, good grappling, good takedown, defense and offense. Goes to the ground. He's shown that he can submit guys. He can avoid submissions. Got a pretty decent chin. So I'm very curious in seeing him fight. I'm very curious to see how he does out there against Wilson Reyes and Chasen Anderson Silva. And for the fans, you need to get behind him a little bit more. And it's tough. I understand that. But Demetrius Johnson chasing history right now is certainly somebody that, when it's all said and done, he's going to be appreciated for what he did, even though he's not appreciated for it now. But he's going to have some records that are going to be standing probably for a long time, especially at the flyweight division. Anyways, guys, that's me on my little soapbox real quick, wrapping up the show. Again, thank you guys for tuning in. I am your host, Kalani Lua. This is Inside the Octagon, which you guys can listen to every Monday evening from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Be sure to get at me on Twitter at KLUA11. That's KLUA11. Also, follow my sports page on Facebook, All Things Sports. Please go there, like it, follow, tell your friends about it, follow. It will tremendously help. Share this video when I post a link on both Twitter and my sports page. Until next week, I'll see you guys then. Enjoy the fights. Enjoy your week. Until then, everybody take care. Peace, love, and soul. Holla.